RCR with Paul Brennan, Reality Check Radio.
John King is a pioneering thinker and educator linking ecology to farming through observation and critical reflection. Trained in Alan Savory's holistic management, John's focus is problem solving and creativity, covering social, financial and environmental aspects of farming. He splits his time between here and Australia, helping farming families and groups discover which questions to ask when regenerating farmland, livelihoods and lifestyles. John, thanks for coming on RCR.
No, thanks. Thanks for having me, Paul. It's great to be here.
Okay, so I want to get on to taking agriculture out of ETS and also the role of regenerative farming and farmers, probably already sequestering carbon using various practices. But first of all, I want to ask you about an opinion piece you wrote. I think it was published in Stuff, headed Why Bear Grylls Should Spearhead Red Meat. I want to read this quote from him. "Nothing is worse for the environment than plant-based stuff full of seed oils. It kills millions and millions of small animals. If you want to do something carbon positive, eat grass-fed, locally sourced cattle that fertilize the land, makes deep roots and protects it from flooding." Quote from Bear Grylls. John, wasn't he a vegan?
Yes. Well, I got onto this. I wrote this because a farmer phoned me up one night and says, "Now, what are we going to do about red meat?" As if I can help a great deal, you know, because no one listens to me either, right? So I happened to find that that quote, and I thought, I remember an interview he did with Louis Theroux, and it blew me into the weeds because he talked about being a vegan, okay? And one of the funniest things he said, he switched to red meat and he stopped farting. Oh. And I mentioned in the article there. Imagine if he'd climbed into a methane chamber, we could have found out how much the vegans are contributing to climate change by the amount of methane that they release, you know. And his story is really significant because he switched because his son, his eldest son, had had health issues from the vegan diet, and he switched to red meat, and they all cleared up within a matter of weeks. And he thought, wow. And he gave himself a go because he'd had one of the early variants of COVID.
Yeah.
And he'd suffered from it. And he said, you know, having more vegetable smoothies wasn't helping. And so he tried it himself. And he said, you know, suddenly you've got more energy. His skin cleared up. His gut issues cleared up. And now he's bulletproof and invisible at the age of 50. You know, that kind of thing, right?
It can't just be the bits of the body, though. I mean, that must do something to your thinking as well. Clear up your thinking a bit.
Wow, that's why I wonder. I mean, one of the things, I guess one of the little quotes I put in there is that he proves by his shows, I think, that eating red meat not only improves your physical stamina and intellectual clarity, but probably, you know, your emotional stability. And he's the top scout in the UK. He's the head scout in the UK. So he's mixing with young people all the time. And his shows are really important in demonstrating how to deal with obstacles and boundaries in life, that kind of thing, about how to go for it, that kind of stuff, right? The idea and as a model for New Zealand produce, you know, it's all about being outside, being active, taking on challenges, all that kind of stuff. He'd be the ideal ambassador in terms of promoting the benefits of red meat. And he knows a fair bit about it. As I point out in one of his shows there, he guts a camel carcass and he sleeps in it. So it's not like
once you've eaten it, you can sleep in it.
Well, that's it. I mean, it's not like he doesn't, he knows the product inside out, so to speak, you know what I mean? And he's eaten everything else under the sun from, goat's testicles to sheep eyes. So, I mean, it's not like that he hasn't tried things out that, we could sell on, that kind of thing. So,
But some of us do observe or comment on when we're chatting with each other, if you're of a certain position, that there does seem to have been a problem with thought processes. There's a kind of an aggression out there. I think people would, well, some people would say it seems to be there, and a lot more road rage being reported as an example, that diet could have been affecting big time the psychology of the masses. This is what I'm just thinking.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I think you guys have had Phyllis Titchener on. She's sort of into that kind of space. And, there's, oh, yeah, yeah. I mean, it's, it's, it's that movement away to, you know, the Franken foods, the manufactured foods. You know, the, you know, people out there that think Coca-Cola and Twinkies or that kind of stuff is actually food. It's not.
Yeah.
And you know, that leads us into the whole thing around, you know, genetic modification, all that kind of stuff.
But you even know, veganism. Yeah. I look at the, I hate to categorize people, but the types, and I don't want to get all hung up on this, but the types who are vegans seem to be the ones who are kind of emotionally unstable and overreact to things and have kind of nonsensical positions to someone like me anyway. I wonder if that's what they're eating.
Well, it could be. I mean, yeah, I don't hang out with vegans. I hang out with livestock farmers, so they tend to eat their own products. So I tend to hang out with people that that I find to be commonsensical and practical, pragmatic, and deep thinkers about what's going on in the world. So
yeah, how deep thinking are farmers? We're out of the ETS now, so that is a coalition agreement kind of point on it, I suppose. Though we had Andrew Hoggard on very recently, and he was telling us about that. But I haven't seen anyone making such a big deal out of it. There's, I think, a member of parliament who's put up a LinkedIn kind of video crowing about it. But I guess the question is, did we even need to be considering that we're going to be in this thing in the first place?
Well, no. I mean, it's, you know, that's, you know, we've got this attitude out there that carbon should be locked away, you know. But really, livestock are a part of that cycling of carbon. You know, they graze the landscape. They put carbon into the soil through, you know, their dung and urine, but also through stimulating the grasses to pump more carbon into the soil. And so that's really important for improving, you know, water infiltration and water holding capacity. It's also important for holding on to more nutrient. It helps lengthen growing seasons because there's more water in the soil. It also helps increase biodiversity in general, because the more biodiversity you have, the more carbon's tied up in living things, and it's not leaching anywhere, okay? So, or volatilizing or anything. So
tying it up in living things is sequestering, isn't it?
Yes, that's the big word for it, Paul. But we just say it's tied up in living things. And and so that's all that's important for maintaining the planet. And you know, as you mentioned before, I'm involved with Alan Savory's ideas. Alan Savory is the only wildlife biologist around the world who says that livestock can save the planet by doing those things, right? There's not a single, I don't know, I'm not aware yet of a single livestock organization around the globe that says, yes, this is the man we should be talking about, okay? No one does that because, you know, he's got a background in ecology and conservation. So, you know, this kind of thing's going on, you know?
Well, I did notice in our chat with Andrew Hoggard that it was all about what markets wanted. So if the market wanted this, we'll give them that. If it wanted the other thing, we'll give them the other thing. It didn't seem to be based on any more expansive principle than that.
Well, exactly. This is like time back to the mid-80s. You might remember the mid-80s, where we shifted from fat lamb to lean lamb. Again, on the same kind of bullshit, right? Based on what the market wanted, which was all being driven by the sugar companies or the sugar corporates, right? And now we know that's not the fact. We know that fat, for example, is not in what provide taste in meat. It's where the medicine is. Okay, that's where all your fat-soluble vitamins are. It actually has the amino acids that break down red meat. So, you know, the tissue part of the red meat, that's what's all in the fats. And we also know that's where all the phytochemicals from the pasture plants are stored, are in the fats. So that's the medicine, right? That's all your phenols and your carotenoids and all those kinds of things that you know, that the meat industry doesn't really look at in terms meat. The meat industry isn't really looking at the health benefits of its own product for the consumer.
Yeah, but that's what they're selling it on, fundamentally. So to ignore that, I don't understand that. What it means that you don't have to take a principled position that might put you in the firing line for criticism. Well, yeah, so what? Don't go for the job. Do something else if you can't handle that. Surely that is the selling point. Absolutely.
Exactly. It's that, you know, that we need meat in our diets. You know, not everybody wants it, but I mean, that's the thing, is that if you want those benefits, and we see that with Bear Grylls, then in his experiences, then you know, you need red meat somewhere in your diet. We should be promoting that, and not just New Zealand, but globally, the value of red meat. You know,
so well, they're happy to alter the genetics of animals to try and fulfil this, you know, we'll do anything for the market.
Well, that's, you know, that's, I mean, we've seen what the impact of GMOs have been doing in America for the last 30 years. You know, and as I say, if GMO was really the silver bullet, they'd be in the media here. They'd be rolling out North American farmers just celebrating how they've become zillionaires overnight by planting these GMO crops and stuff. But there's no advantage for the farmer regarding yield, particularly in droughts. There's no advantage regarding the price that they get for the product. Okay, there's no advantage for the consumer in terms of the nutritional value, and more importantly, there's no advantage in terms of the taste. And if you know, and this is one of the reasons why I think that you know with COVID, America had one of the highest death rates in anywhere in the world because they're eating foods that are GMO, amongst all the other crap that they eat there too. But I mean, that's why is that they're so unhealthy that if anything gets into their system, they don't have the ability to be able to fight it off.
Why do you think there's an obsession with sequestering carbon with planting trees that some might argue don't even belong here and ignoring all the other? I mean, there's a lot of land mass. There's a lot of carbon absorbing material facing off into the universe. That is never in the equation. I don't get that.
Well, I mean, are we really in a climate emergency? You know, the Labor government declared
that. Well, I don't think we are.
We're not. And I'll tell you why. It's that, you know, you go to the Department of Conservation, right? What is it about the climate emergency that they've missed? They're still chopping down the wilding pines. If we were truly on a war footing regarding the climate change, then we'd be allowing the wilding pines to march across the high country and suck in all that carbon, right? And so the government knows that it's not real. Otherwise, they'd be doing something about it. They'd be changing the law. We'd be moving from a Department of Preservation, which is what it is, right, to something else, right? I mean, I talk to farmers about this, and they say, look, you go to a border in the high country with a farmer and the Department of Conservation. On one side of the fence, you're going to see a solid, thriving tussock grassland, sucking in moisture from when it rains, sucking in the carbon, putting that into the soil, longer growing season, more biodiversity. Oh, and by the way, that side's also paying rates and taxes. Then you jump over the fence, and what do you see? You find bitty bids and bare soil. And that's the best that all the wealth, knowledge, and power of the government can do. And so you know, and you can see that from any Google map, you know?
Yeah, but even just the grass on a farm is absorbing carbon, is it not?
Exactly. Your grass in your lawn pool will be doing that, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
So same thing. So it's pulling that. That's the whole job of it. There's a guy called Walter Yenny who I met many years ago. He's an Australian microbiologist and climatologist, and he explained to me about you know how all this got started. He talks about you know the Scripps Oceanography Institute in California being picked up by the Carter Institute, Carter administration, right? And yes, they had to look at this whole thing around climate change. This was in the late '70s. And yeah, CO2 has a significant impact on heat dynamics. Okay, so another word for emissions is heat. And that accounted to about 4%. What accounted to 95% was water vapor. Water vapor has a much greater, that's because the water molecule flexes and it's able to hold the heat. That's my understanding of it, right? And he says they didn't look at that because they thought it was a too big a thing that humans could interfere with. But we know that's not true. The biggest, what interferes with that the most is the ability of the soil to absorb the rainfall. Right. The more rainfall that there is that gets absorbed into the soil, the less water vapor there is floating around the atmosphere. That has an impact on the climate. And at the moment, what's happening is that with our agriculture, we're producing soils that don't absorb rainfall. And that's what's contributing to the frequency of droughts and floods. We're seeing, you know, all these places around the globe that are now, flooding. Prior to that, last summer, it'd be all the big wildfires, okay, that kind of thing. So there's these climatic events, but how much is actually related back to the ability of soils to absorb moisture and be greener for longer? So that's one of the things that's what Walter Yenny, and you can go find him on YouTube. There's loads of videos of what he's talking about on there, explaining all of this kind of stuff, the biochemistry, all that kind of thing. So
this is all performative then. Being seen to do something. necessarily believing in it. You don't have to believe in it. It just need to be seen to be doing something.
Well, that's what we're seeing. And I mean, and they're being, you know, the meat companies now are being called out about what their stance is. And in fact, there's been a bit in the media about that where, you know, they've been accused of running these slick PR programs where, you know, when it comes to likes of the question and answer, they shut the farmers down. They know who the troublemakers are going to be in the audience, so they either delay their questions to the end of the meeting when they run out of time, or they simply just put them aside and go, we're not going to take questions from you because we know that you're basically a troublemaker.
Yeah.
And so you know, the farmers have had a gutsful of this kind of shenanigans that are going on that aren't reflecting the reality that they see what's going on with their operations, and that they've got a lot to contribute to the way that the climate works.
I got a feeling that regenerative farming, and it's only something I've come to recently since I've been at RCR, talking to people about it, some very well-known people, it seems to me that this is the obvious, well, I'd say way of the future. It's actually a way of the past as well. But yes, where we need to go, the direction we need to go, there's kind of no argument against it, except, of course, entrenched positions wanting to maintain an advantage. Do you feel that way as well? It's just a matter of time?
Yes, it is. I think, you know, it's just going to take time for, like you say, those entrenched positions to slowly wobble and fall over. And, you know, because if I go and ask scientists what regen is, they all fumble around for a definition. They're all looking for a definition. But by its very name, you know, it's already about fixing something.
Well, it's obvious.
Yeah, you know, and if it's the soil, then, you know, like if I go to a group of farmers and ask them, put your hand up if water's essential to your business, and they all put their hands up, right?
Yeah.
And then I ask, well, can you tell me what your rainfall infiltration rate is in your front paddock? And all the hands come down. Okay. And they go, hang on, is water essential? All the hands go up, you know? So there's, you know, as I say to them, is there another business industry with such a critical resource that they wouldn't know about the efficiency of what they're using it with, you know? There isn't.
You'd want to know that inside out.
Yeah. Maybe the exception is in farming is the banks, right? The banks are on the same side as everybody else in terms of dragging the chain over, okay? You know, which is funny because in Australia, they're already on board. But as I've pointed out before, is that, you know, the pipeline of ideas from Australia to New Zealand is very, very small, very, very thin, and it's clogged up with ego and reputation and attitudes and all the rest of it. So that's why it struggles to get to the industry here, you know.
And that's the what so-called expert scientific field with the egos and reputations at stake. I mean, is that more important than successful farming?
Well, I don't know. No. I mean, it's like anything. I mean, you know, your reputation is based on what you do. And if you're at the end of your career, you've spent 30, 40 years promoting one thing, and then someone's turned around and said, well, actually, that's all wrong. And if you've got a Y chromosome, well, maybe it's not just for Y chromosome people, but I mean, everybody, is that, you know, that's confronting.
Yeah, and, too bad, boo-hoo. Yes. You make your choices in life, and to admit that you might have been wrong is can be quite a big thing and a cathartic thing to do. Okay, so we're out of the ETS. Some might think that you know, gives a pass to agriculture where other sectors are bound up in this. What is the next stage, do you think, in advancing what we're talking about?
I think I was talking with someone the other day that's involved with politics, and they were talking about there's hopefully now an appetite for cross-party talks around re-looking at agriculture and looking at new ideas about what we should be looking at, you know, in terms of what the market really wants, you know. And one of those things, I mean, they were talking about examples in Ireland, for example, where they're making it easier for farmers to go organic, because organic's the most recognized sort of brand in this regen space, right? Because it changes what inputs that you use. Okay, so that's one of the things that they're looking at it on, is making it easier for farmers to be organic, more challenging for them to be throwing a lot of inputs and other things to making production more complex. Okay, so that's one of the things they're looking at. One of the really interesting things that's come out of Ireland in recent years is to do with grazing management and to do with the composition of diets that animals are fed, and limiting the crude protein to about 17%, And when I heard that figure, that was really interesting because I remember talking to a biochemist many years ago, and he says, once you get over 17% crude protein in a ruminant diet, it becomes uneconomic to balance it. Now, what's significant is that New Zealand pasture is anywhere between 22 to 30% protein. And so dairy farmers in particular spend an awful lot of time buying carbohydrates. So that's your maize, silage, hay, you know, that kind of, you know, the bulk, what you would call the bulk or the, you know, the carbohydrate products. And that becomes the expensive part of the diet, right? That's quite expensive. And so the Irish are now looking at trying to limit that, but they've found that even at that level of protein, plus at 15 or even 13% protein, it's made no difference at all to production. Really interesting. So okay. It'd be interesting to see if that, if that ends up, you know, making its way over here to New Zealand, okay, that kind of thing, because I think that's got a huge benefit. How you make it work is another story, but because that's challenging. But the point is that it's healthier for the animal. You get a different kind of milk with that. You'll get actually what's going to happen. Well, I didn't realize this until someone told me the other day that Fonterra, for example, imports in 100,000 tons of lactose to add to milk that they send overseas because it doesn't reach international standards, and that's because of the excess protein. Okay, right, so the protein is replacing the carbohydrate, you know, that kind of thing, right? So, really interesting idea there. So it'll be better for the milk. It's also better for the animal. And farmers that have a greater balance between carbohydrate and protein, those lower levels, get more animals pregnant, that kind of thing. So that's also better for production as well. So there's a lot of benefits to be had when we get that diet thing right. And there's less emissions. Will your nitrous oxide start to decline? That greenhouse gas emissions that they're so panicking about, all of a sudden that all changes. And that doesn't require a vaccine or a bolus, all the other things all this other stuff that they're investing millions in through companies like AgriZero, they're either measuring the symptoms, that kind of technology, or they're investing in stuff that treats the symptoms, never the root cause. The root cause is usually management, right? It's not nitrogen that's the problem, it's how we manage it.
Yeah.
Okay. It's like coal. Coal's not the problem. It's how we manage the coal that's the problem, and that kind of thing, right? So that's what's being missed in a lot of these things, and we need another look at agriculture in terms of how it actually functions and how.
Sounds
it actually
like we
works
need
with
a summit, like a summit.
A summit. You know, more talking. We just need people to act.
Well, but you've got to find a way of create the conditions for people to confidently act.
Yes, I get what you mean.
That might need a bit of clearing of the decks.
Yeah. So, no, it's certainly a possibility. And we actually haven't had an event like that for a while, actually, something that along those kinds of lines.
Well,
so,
I think the last one was when the Labor government did the economic summit, remember? Mid-80s, that was ages ago. But inevitably, because it's not just farming practices and getting the food manufactured and out, is it? It's a way of life. It's a culture. It's been evolving through that for thousands of years. And with the technocratic model, it really doesn't accommodate, well, less and less anyway, the human component of farming as it sort of tightens up and goes in that route. So farmers, in the end, are going to have to make a call whether they want to live like this anymore or live another way. That's a pretty binary, stark choice in the end.
Well, no, there's I wrote a book last year called Curiosity, Farmers Discovering What Works. And there's a whole lot of case studies in there about farmers that have picked up industry information, and in the vast majority of cases, it hasn't met their expectations. And so where do they go next when you can't trust the industry, right? And it's stories about mixing with other farmers and sorting things out together, that kind of thing. And so what they do is that there's an appetite out there for doing things differently than what the industry says is right. It's already there, right? And that's why you're seeing this angst with, you know, these roadshows with the meat companies, that kind of thing at the moment. There's huge issues around attitudes. There was even just towards even organics. You know, it's still surprising at how deeply entrenched they are. There's a story about a politician a couple of years ago whose family's involved with organic dairy farming, and they won an award. And at the award, the top table found out that this person was at the table with the organic farmers. And they ran down to the table and says, oh my God, we're so sorry that you're sitting next to these polluting, stinking, nasty organic farmers. Next time we have one of these events, we'll put you at the top table. And, you know, there's that, you know, she turned around and said, you know, that's my family, you know, and you would think that, you know, the sad thing was it still took, you know, a week for her to get a letter of apology. You would think organizations like that would have 100 apology letters sitting on file for an intern to go and find, spend 20 minutes on to go and find, and then send off to the legal department, you know, but no, it took a whole week. So there's these attitudinal issues that we're still trying to deal with. And that's happening on lots of fronts. There's, again, with my book, I had a university lecturer contact me about it and say, wow, these ideas, and we don't teach any of these ideas at the university. And they said, I don't know how I'm going to put it in front of the students because all the lectures now are videoed for the content committee. So, you know, you're moving away from, you know, you're moving almost to an indoctrination around, around, you know, information. You know, this is how sad it's becoming. And you don't know what stake
those committee members have, who they're associated with, what patents they might be.
You kind of do, because it's all within the university, so they all know each other. But even just some of the basic stuff out there, there's other issues that farmers are battling with. Overseer is another classic, right? That should be gone, right? And so that overseer is the nutrient modelling that all the regional councils get farmers to put their numbers into to try and figure out how much pollution is actually going on. And there was a court case several years back where the judge basically said, you know, to the scientific community, to the policymakers, to the consultants, how unjust it was to financially penalise farmers based on a technology that could be up to 50%. If your bathroom scales were up to 50% and you didn't know which direction they were going to go in, what level of trust would you have with the technology, let alone the people that designed and developed it, with your money? This is one of the problems that we've got. The industry says, oh, no, we had agreement from the farmers. I said, I've yet to meet a single farmer that says that was aware that they would not only be investing into this technology, but also be penalised at the other end with its inaccuracies, you know, that kind of thing. So this is why you've got this angst going on with the farmers and the professional community that's supposed to be helping them, but it's doing the opposite. And it's even worse. Yeah. I mean, there's a guy running around, he's semi-retired now, Barry Ridler. Barry Ridler's an ex-agricultural economist, was a sheep and beef farmer for 17 years, so, you know, he knows what happens inside the farm gate. He developed a little bit of AI, a little AI program that can help farmers identify what's known as the marginal value, the point where every dollar spent is no longer producing profit in your business, actually consuming profit. Mm. And it's quite unique. But the industry has never looked at it. Uses other programs like FarmMax, for example, which is another financial program. Now, FarmMax averages all the costs. And now there's a gap between where it ends up as its marginal value and where Barry Ridler's program ends up with its marginal value. Yay big, right? And so that gap represents additional inputs that the farmer is putting into the business because of FarmMax is always higher. Now, the industry takes that figure and goes to the government and says, this is the minimum that we need to make farms work, when that's actually not true. And so the gap between Barry's figure and the industry figure is where the pollution comes from. So as Barry points out, if you can get your economics right, the pollution disappears because the plants are using all the nutrients that you put on your land to that point. After it, it's being either volatilized or it's being leached. But the industry doesn't want to listen to that kind of argument, right? They've got their program. They're happy with that. They don't want to change it. The banks have got it all and locked in, all that kind of stuff. No one wants to look at other ways of doing things. That's where the sadness is.
That's probably a good line to end on in this chat, maybe. Any final words? We've burned through half an hour already. We could probably go for another half hour or hour on this. I got a feeling that I've said this before about other things, and I'm usually never right, but I got a feeling that we don't have to wait too long before this goes back to being mainstream farming, because in the end, the economics are going to determine it, aren't they?
Well, it's going to depend on the industry. The farmers are probably ready. Okay, it's just whether the industry wants to, because you know, the problem with the industry is that you know, like one farmer says, have you ever got an apology from someone with a PhD? it's about as rare as trying to find a car park in front of Eden Park at a test, you know. So, you know, that's the problem, is that, like I said, there's a lot of egos involved, and until they can put that aside, you know, it's going to be the farmers that are going to have to drive it. And, you know, we're going to have to do what they've been doing in the UK for the last week and drive more tractors up the main street into Wellington.
More of that is required, part of the mix, you know.
Yeah,
it's been done before, but it can be done again.
Exactly.
And maybe what do the French do? They dump manure on the steps. Could do that too, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. All good.
John King, it's been interesting hearing your thoughts on RCR this morning. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you, Paul. It's been great.
The RCR shop has great gift ideas, from great looking tees, hoodies, caps, tote bags, bumper stickers, and more. The RCR shop is now open at www.realitycheck.radio/shop.